supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
A big name in Pennsylvania politics has endorsed a candidate for Philadelphia District Attorney. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that in a seven-person Democratic primary, the endorsement could be a big help.
Ed Rendell says he interviewed three Democrats running for district attorney before deciding Joe Kahn is the best man for the job.
I saw Rich Negrin, who I'd worked with when he was managing director, and I have a high regard for Rich, and I think he'd make a good DA. It's just that I think that Joe would make a great DA. And I saw Michael Untermyer, who worked for me when I was district attorney, and who I think is well-motivated and wants to do the right thing. But I think Joe Kahn has the ability to be a game-changer for the justice system.
Kahn says the show of support from Rendell, who's been mayor, governor, and district attorney, will help with his name recognition in the crowded field. He says it will give him the chance to be heard on his merits.
What I learned in my 6 years at the DA's office was how to take on tough fights, how to not only pursue convictions of the dangerous and the guilty, but to exonerate the innocents.
Former Republican mayoral candidate Sam Katz says the endorsement is important for the young first-time candidate.
If Ed Rendell also gets on the phone and raises money and engages his network, that's a big deal. And it's an imprimatur of a good housekeeping seal of approval by a guy we all know. So that's a big deal.
A spokesman for Rich Negrin says his candidate has been endorsed by dozens of local community leaders from all over the city. Michael Untermyer, who has the largest campaign war chest, says he's focusing on the issues rather than endorsements. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Meanwhile, in the office of the current DA, Community Legal Services, one of the city's main filers of expungement petitions in Philadelphia, contends that since the start of the year, the district attorney's office has been objecting to far more cases. Details from WHYY's Aaron Mozell.
Community Legal Services files hundreds of expungement petitions each year for low-income Philadelphians. Many are requests for what's called a redaction, a partial expungement that clears some charges from an individual's criminal record, often ones they were never convicted of. Others remain, often permanently. Staff attorney Jamie Gullen says in the past, prosecutors with the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office rarely objected to partial expungements, and so they were often granted the first time they came up in court, on the spot. These days, though, Gullen says these types of petitions and others are routinely drawing objections from the office, the biggest thing standing in the way of someone trying to get an expungement. In March of 2016, the DA's office objected to 13% of petitions. A year later, that percentage more than tripled. Gullen says the vast majority of these petitions are ultimately granted at a later court date, but that the bump is still significant.
Because every time there's an objection to an expungement petition, clients have to take off of work, arrange child care, come to court. Often their cases end up being continued again.
Gullen says the average wait time for an initial hearing is already 4 to 5 months.
People who really were in desperate need of a job the day they came into our office are sometimes waiting over a year or more before they can actually finally walk into that job interview and feel confident that those non-conviction charges aren't going to show up on their record.
Michael Berry is deputy district attorney of the office's pretrial division. He supervises all expungement cases. When it comes to petitions for redactions, Berry says prosecutors object only when the case contains a negotiated guilty plea. He says lawyers at CLS don't think that's right.
They have every right to take that position, and I'm not faulting them for taking that position. It is not news to them that we're going to object to that position, however.
Berry adds that last month was exponentially busier than other months because the petitions from a citywide expungement clinic hit the docket. Gullen, the staff attorney, says a number of the redaction petitions from March were cases with guilty pleas. But she says she's still left wondering, why did the DA's office start objecting to these cases? Berry says the DA's office has been objecting to such cases since at least 2001. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
The future of Philadelphia's tax on soda and other sweetened drinks was debated today in front of state appeals judges. The panel met for its April session in Pittsburgh, and WHYY's Bobby Allen was there.
The life or death of Philly's so-called soda tax may come down to one law from 1932. It's known as the Sterling Act. Here's Mark Aronchick with the city's legal team explaining it.
If we tax it, meaning the Commonwealth, then Philadelphia can't. If we are not taxing it, Philadelphia can.
He told the judges that the tax hits distributors of sweetened beverages. The state is not currently taxing them. So he says it's not an illegal double tax. But Shane Inspector, representing the beverage industry, says, well, the distributor passes the extra cost onto stores, so it becomes a de facto sales tax.
It taxes the same subject as the state sales tax, which is soda, and that makes it unlawful under the Sterling Act.
Anyone who's been following this debate has heard this back and forth before. But here's the big difference now. How this 7-judge panel comes down could either keep the soda tax legal or completely destroy it. Aronchick says any time there's a new tax proposed in Pennsylvania, an affected industry comes running in and tries to stop it, claiming,
sky is falling, Chicken Little, slippery slope, everything is going to go upside down if you allow this tax.
The argument of the city seemed to focus more on the economic power of the soda industry, which is a political argument, not a legal argument.
That was Spector again. More pre-kindergarten programs and better parks and rec centers were not brought up in court, nor were the health impacts of cutting soda consumption, because neither of them has anything to do with the legal debate. Still, Aronchick says those elements should not be forgotten.
We're talking about educating 3- and 4-year-old children. We're talking about obesity and diabetes. We're talking about infrastructure rebuilding and crumbling playgrounds.
But Spector and his legal team are asking that a lower court decision be reversed and that the tax be stopped immediately. A decision is expected in the coming weeks. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
When more than 500,000 Southeast Asians fled to the United States in the 1970s and 80s as refugees of the Vietnam War, Americans were just as divided about whether to accept them as they are now about welcoming refugees from Syria and other countries. At that time, the federal government made the unpopular choice to double down on the number of people it would take in and created a formal resettlement system. Today, the Trump administration is taking a much stricter stance. And as WHYY's Katie Culinary reports, it's sparking memories and mixed reactions for Philadelphia's refugees from Vietnam and Cambodia.
When Cambodia's genocidal regime, known as the Khmer Rouge, was defeated in 1979, the nightmare was not over for people like Kha Or. Together, Or, his wife, young son, and mother-in-law walked to Thailand.
I passed 2 minefields. I'm lucky, but the person who came after me, they stepped on the mine, and the body blew.
They lived in a dusty, crowded refugee camp for nearly 2 years, until in 1981, they settled in South Philadelphia.
And the first time that I came here, I saw a lot of black people. So I said, hey, maybe they put me to the wrong place, right? Because I saw it's America, they're all maybe white, you know?
In the late 1970s and 80s, Philadelphia became a prime destination for Southeast Asian refugees like the Orrs. Resettlement agencies could easily find cheap housing for them in the row homes left behind by white residents, leaving in droves for the suburbs. But refugee families quickly discovered that they'd been placed in neighborhoods already simmering with racial tension.
When there's only one of you, you're not much of a threat.
Toi Nguyen was 9 when his parents and siblings were airlifted out of Vietnam in 1975. They were among the first refugee families resettled in South Philadelphia along 7th Street. Nguyen says in the beginning, they felt welcomed by their neighbors. But 4 years later, things changed as more and more and more families from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos began showing up.
Now you have hundreds of families literally changing the demographic makeup of the neighborhood overnight. So it created a very curious situation for me personally.
By then, Nguyen was a teenager, and his mostly white friends had strong reactions to these newcomers.
They would refer to the new refugees as, you know, chinks or gooks in front of me. And I had to remind them that, hey, you guys, those people are me. You know, so if they're chinks, and I'm a chink in your eyes.
Three decades later, Southeast Asians have become part of the fabric of life in South Philly, opening restaurants, filling churches and Buddhist temples, and creating community organizations. And like a lot of Americans, they have mixed feelings about the Trump administration's stricter stance on refugees and his proposal to enact extreme vetting. Cambodian refugee Ka Orr says he doesn't pay much attention to American politics, but thinks the U.S. treats people fairly. But Toy Nguyen, now a community activist, takes it personally when he hears Trump's tough talk about refugees and immigrants.
Even though the administration's call is primarily targeting undocumented or illegal Mexicans and Muslims, there is a sense that they're not exactly like us, but he's talking about us too.
Others see things differently. Chin Dinh served in the South Vietnamese Navy and fled to the U.S. in 1975 when the country fell to the communist Viet Cong. Dinh believes the U.S. government has to be even more careful about who it accepts because of the threat of terrorism, something that was not considered when he and his family arrived from war-torn Vietnam.
In my own opinion, maybe just need to vet people more carefully, that's all. But then a lot of the refugees, they are good people. Not all of them are terrorists, everything. Maybe just a few of them. But we need to vet them to make sure that we accept the good people.
He says the government needs to do what the government needs to do to make sure Americans like him are safe. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Jake Blumgard of WHYY's Plan Philly co-reported this story. And there's more on this topic tomorrow morning at 10 on Radio Times with Marty Moscowane. The Philadelphia Theater Company has a new artistic leader. Paige Price was the artistic director of Theater Aspen in Colorado and now heads the theater company housed inside the Suzanne Roberts Theater on Broad Street. She'll replace Sarah Garonczyk, who stepped down after 34 years with the Philadelphia Theater Company. The company hit hard financial times recently, even temporarily losing its theater in a bank foreclosure, which was resolved in 2015. WHYY's Peter Crimmins sat down with Price to ask about the future of the company.
First and foremost, as new producing artistic director of the Philadelphia Theater Company, why do you want this job? Why did you take this job?
Well, after 10 years in the mountains, I wanted to come back east where my roots are. I grew up in New Jersey, and the city's so diverse and so cultural, and there's a lot of opportunity, I think, in this town with the talent that's available and the proximity to other centers of culture. So it's a big step up for me.
What do you see you can do in Philadelphia that you couldn't do in Aspen?
So many things. Theater Aspen did a summer season which was very focused on entertainment and resort-type summer fare. And one of the appealing things about a typical theater season during, you know, the September to June months is that you're able to explore more serious subjects. And then it is not focused on people that are escaping necessarily. So you can build some of that in. But the kind and the variety and the number of shows that I'd be able to do here frees me up a lot creatively. And we do repertory in Aspen, which we are not doing here. And repertory is a really different Rubik's Cube to try to figure out when you're programming.
Recently, the Philadelphia Theater Company has had its problems. I mean, it temporarily lost its theater, went into foreclosure a little bit. There's been some money issues. And you're coming into this. I mean, some of those financial problems have been resolved. How are you going to deal with it?
Well, I came in eyes wide open. One of the things I like to do is raise money. So if anyone out there wants to meet me, I'm happy to take a coffee. But I like to raise money. I feel really strongly about our mission, and I feel really strongly about what we do. And I think that finding those pockets of support that perhaps didn't exist before or need to be reinvigorated will be my job. And I think that this should be a really important regional theater, and that's what I'm going to pitch.
Now, you mentioned in a newspaper interview that you, as producing artistic director here, you're going to shoot for the moon. That's what some of you said. And I'm wondering what you mean by that. I mean, in terms of the Philadelphia Theater Company, in what direction lies the moon? I mean, what are you going to go for?
Well, one of the things I do want to do is survey our current audience and find out what floats their boat. And I have an R&D year to do that. So I'm going to throw some spaghetti at the wall, too, and try to engage with our donors and have coffees and drink nights at the theater in the lobby and just invite people so I can hear what they want to do. Because I think developing what our niche wants to be in this ecosystem is going to be important. There are so many theaters in Philadelphia, that I think refocusing what our identity wants to be is part of my job coming in. And so when I say shoot for the moon, I don't think what we want to do is find the safest fare and the titles that everybody knows. I don't think that that is compelling in this time and age. So I think we want to be more creative, but not program it in a vacuum. I'm going to really insist on a conversation with our donors and with the audiences that have come or not come.
Now, your predecessor, Sarah Goranczyk, was there for a very long time, almost 35 years. That's a long time to hold a job. and the theater artistically has really been defined by her and the people that she works with. And so I'm wondering how you feel about stepping into shoes that have been filled by someone else for 35 years. That's a long tenure.
That is a crazy long tenure. Well, I certainly don't want to be the rebound girl. So I think it's incumbent upon me to take the legacy of what she's created and the reputation that she's created and build upon it and, you know, just be part of the – I keep using the word regenerate because I feel like the chrysalis, you have to form your new identity. And that's kind of what I feel like. And I'm very sensitive to honoring tradition, and yet I think it's an opportunity to take a look at everything and talk to the people that have worked for the organization and are passionate about the organization and start with those people.
Now, I don't know if Philadelphia Theater Company has already coordinated its next season, the 2017-2018 season, or if that's going to, if you're going to have a hand in what will be programmed next season.
I think that's a good example of a way that I'm working with Sarah to plan out the next year. And I don't want to be coy, but we can't quite say what it's going to be
next year. Okay, so it has not been determined. Okay.
But I've been talking to Sarah for several months about what that might look like.
So your hand will be part of next season, however the next season pans out. We'll have to wait to see what exactly that's going to be. I'm speaking with Paige Price. She's the new incoming producing artistic director of the Philadelphia Theater Company. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Paige Price spoke with WHYY arts and culture reporter Peter Crimmins. Staying with theater, summer is typically Shakespeare's big season. And a few miles north of Quakertown, the Pennsylvania Shakespeare Festival operates during the warmest months, and outdoor troupes perform Shakespeare in parks locally and across the region. Currently, though, the Bard has taken over springtime, too, with three of his plays running simultaneously at local theaters. More from Newsworks Theater blogger Howard Shapiro.
It's pure coincidence that three professional theater companies are putting up Shakespeare's work all at once in a sort of springtime big Bard bonanza. All three produce Shakespeare from time to time as part of their regular seasons, but no one conspired to offer Philadelphians an Elizabethan feast. That's what it is, though. Producing Shakespeare can be a good deal for a stage company. He died 401 years ago, so there's no family around to collect royalties. And there's no one to sue you if you edit him down, a standard practice by directors for modern audiences. Plus, he brings in all those school kids, mostly to extra performances in the morning, a boon to the box office as well as to students and teachers. But that's all icing. The cake is Shakespeare himself. The galloping plots, the enormous range of emotional baggage his plays pack, and right now in Philadelphia, the two productions I've seen set extraordinary bars that they reach. That's some original music by Alex Bechtel from Arden Theater's A Midsummer Night's Dream, the giddy comedy produced so often around the country, you'd think no one could find anything new in it. But that's the magic of great theater. I've seen A Midsummer Night's Dream more times than I can remember, yet never like the Arden show that Matt Pfeiffer inventively directs. Full of music the cast plays and sings, sophisticated comic interpretations, and high-level physicality. Mary Twilmanen leads with her spunky, irresistible portrayal of the sprite Puck, and everyone has a great time bringing the play alive. Not far from the Arden in Center City, Lantern Theater Company offers Shakespeare of a completely different sort. His play Coriolanus, about the so-named warrior forced into Roman politics, has unseemly connections to our times. And the production, directed by Lantern Theater's leader Charles McMahon, exploits them forcefully. When there's action in the Roman marketplace, we see it both on stage and broadcast onto the walls as breaking news live from station SPQR. As the people turn against Coriolanus and the city's tribunes spread what amounts to fake news, this play about hubris and revenge is almost unbearably current. yet Shakespeare wrote every word, beautifully delivered from a sparkling cast headed by Robert Lyons as Coriolanus. The city's third concurrent Shakespeare production is in Mount Airy, where Quintessence Theatre Group is staging Love's Labour's Lost, about schoolboys who make a questionable pact to stop chasing women and tend to their studies. All three shows run to about the middle of the month. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
Philadelphians turn to 311, the city's non-emergency contact center, to find out when trash is collected or how to request services such as a pothole repair or removal of an abandoned car. But you may not know what happens between the time when you call and when the problem is addressed. We're inviting Tim Thornton, director of Philly 311, to join us on NewsWorks Tonight this Friday. He'll field your questions about the history and purpose of the department, its range of services, and improvements to customer feedback. You can participate in the conversation by calling our comment line now at 484-800-1311. That's 484-800-1311. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.